Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
So my name is PJ Blunt. I am an assistant professor of space law at Durham University. And I found my way into my profession through a back door. I wrote a master's thesis on this topic because I kind of thought that it would be funny. And then a job opened up and I thought, hey, I've got a writing sample for that. And now I'm the expert.
That's amazing. And for our students who don't know what space law is, can you kind of cover a little bit like what exactly that kind of is?
Sure. So I'll give you what I call the party version of space law. So essentially in 1957, Sputnik is launched. And it's the first human-made object that orbits the Earth. And what this caused was sort of a moment of crisis in the world, because the United States looked over and thought, well, the Soviet Union can now launch something at us. And the Soviet Union was looking at the United States, and they were like, well, they're going to have this technology soon. And maybe, just maybe, we should come up with a way to kind of avoid some conflict here. And so from that, we get five international treaties that govern outer space. And these treaties sort of set out fundamental principles for how states are going to interact in space. And that's the core of what I do. But even beyond that, at the national level, we have all sorts of laws that regulate the telecommunications aspects of space, as well as licensing launches and licensing satellites to go into orbit. So it exists both at the international level and the national level.
So I'm already getting a litany of questions like emailed to me. And one of the kids, they wanted to know, with private companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin launching missions, how does space law kind of adapt to regulate both government and commercial activities in space?
So, yeah, for the most of the time that we've been in space, we've been thinking about space law in terms of regulating governments. But really, in the 1980s in the United States, we began to look at the notion that we might have private actors. And so there's been sort of this march of space law in the United States very specifically that's dealt with this issue of private actors. And what we do, so the international legal regime requires states to authorize and continually supervise their space actors. And so we use licensing regimes for this. So, and I'm a U.S. lawyer, so I'll give the U.S. example. In the United States, if you want to launch something, you have to go to the Federal Aviation Administration, and they're going to give you a license for launch. If you want to communicate with your satellite, which is really important, then you're going to go to the Federal Communications Commission, and they're going to license the frequency that you use. If you're going to have a satellite that looks back down at Earth, a remote sensing satellite, then you go to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and they give you a license for that activity. And so as we move forward in time, we keep refining these laws. And currently, there's a whole other sort of push to reduce the regulatory burden on these actors while at the same time managing the risk that comes from space activities.
There's a lot of ethical challenges, I'm sure, like in your profession when we're talking about exploration on the moon and exploration on Mars and all that kind of stuff. What kind of hurdles have you seen in your profession the further we get out in space and, you know, all this different talk about exploration and, you know, making contact and all this kind of stuff? How does it like delve into the legal?
So, I mean, I think that from an ethical perspective, one of the biggest questions that we've been dealing with, and this really kind of raised its head again in the 80s, and we saw it through the 90s, and we're seeing it again today, is a big question about distribution. This notion that there are states that can do this. They have the technology, they can go out there. And so right now we're talking about going and getting space resources, mining the moon, mining asteroids. And so now the question is, well, what about developing nations? What about states that don't have these capabilities? They should have a part of this as well. And the Outer Space Treaty, this core treaty that we have, says that space is to be for the use and exploration of space should be used for all nations. And so this question becomes, how do we balance these two things? How do we allow for innovation, which is coming from states that have these technological capabilities, but at the same time maintain space exploration so that it benefits all of humanity? And that was a big part of space law, is making sure that space benefited everyone, that it was something that went to all of humanity rather than just the states that could.
Interesting. We had a guest recently. She was kind of stranded for a minute up in space. And do you guys delve at all as far as like liabilities when that comes in? Because obviously that wasn't their intention to spend 9 months up in space, and there's probably some, emotional distress and damage from something. I can't imagine, I mean, that's just like getting stuck in a room for 9 months that you can't leave and you don't know when you're coming down. But do you guys delve at all, like when it comes to astronaut liabilities or anything like that?
So actually, there's in the U.S. there's a regime that governs this, and we have sort of two different cat or actually three different categories. We have government astronauts, and government astronauts are those that go up with a government mission, and they are sort of governed by the employee regulations that apply to governments. And there's actually been cases after the Challenger and Columbia disasters. There have been cases about, how do we pay out in these types of situations? And that goes back to federal law and how we treat government employees. We have the personnel of the spacecraft. And the personnel of the spacecraft, probably the category of the individual you're just talking about, are going to be governed by the contract, their personnel contract with that company. And whether or not they have a claim is going to depend a lot on their employment contract. But we have this final category, which is the spaceflight participant, which is easily understood as the space tourist, right? All these people that are going up on Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic. And this is a really interesting category because when you get on an airplane, right, you're a passenger. And as a passenger, you have rights. It used to be that you could flip your ticket over. We've sort of gotten away from it. You could flip your ticket over and you could see the rights written on the little contract on the back. A spaceflight participant doesn't have those rights. In fact, a spaceflight participant is going to sign a piece of paper that says that they have informed consent that they might die on this flight. And by signing that, they're going to lose most of their rights to gain liability against the company that's launched them in the case of a disaster. It would really take some sort of, intentional or gross negligence to overcome that liability. And so that's how it's governed in the United States with these three categories of people that can go into space.
That's interesting. So an assumed risk. If you're gonna shoot yourself 30 miles up into the sky, like it's kind of on you. So
It is. And we actually, the law was built around adventure law. So they reached out to an Alaskan lawyer who wrote contracts for whitewater rafting companies and backwoods companies that send people out there. And so the informed consent law in the United States is actually built on sort of adventure law.
that's now my new favorite term, adventure law. So
It's a good one.
I love it. That is very fascinating, very interesting. You mentioned about the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. Obviously there's a different variables here. How do you guys like handle like misinformation? Because I know that we have Atlas 31 or 31 Atlas, whatever, that giant thing that's kind of coming near us. I don't know, right our way, but we hear all these different kind of things. Do you guys handle like misinformation or anything like that?
So not directly. I will. There is at least one example though that I can think of and that I'll throw out. And I'm not really an expert in this field, so it's only kind of going to be a reference, and you'll have to go to Google to get more. But in the SETI crowd, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, they actually have a protocol on how, if they discover a signal that they think is intelligent life from elsewhere in the universe, there's a protocol on how that information is distributed. And that protocol is there to keep it from being bound up, right? This notion is, well, if we give it to a government first, then there will be a lack of trust in the information. And so that protocol goes down, and I haven't looked at it in a very long time, but I think it the information goes to media first and then to governments and civil society. And so that's sort of one example of this. But Space Law itself doesn't really dive so much into this notion of misinformation.
Yeah, it's just such a weird time because, especially for these kids on this call, like I can't imagine. Like when we were kids, it was just like it was very much the Cold War, and you know, America against Russia. It's like Rocky IV, and it's just we travel to space, we win, and all this different stuff. But then you're like, okay, now what? Because it's like the next frontier. We're going to touch a little bit more on this. We're going to let you go in a few minutes because I know it's getting kind of late for some of the kids in Eastern Europe. But where do you see space going? Do you really think that there's going to be space tourism like in our lifetime or even our kids' lifetime? Not space tourism, like if you're a billionaire, you can go travel to space like Jeff Bezos or something, but just like, you know, regular folk, you know, like as if we have it now with just airline travel.
I think we're a long way away from it. And in the space community, you get different answers on this. There are some people that think it's right around the corner. Launch is still really expensive. It's very expensive to send people to space. It's very expensive to send things to space. And even though we've seen sort of dramatic drops in launch cost, it's still just very, very expensive to put an object into space. And when you put a human in there, that makes it more expensive because you have all sorts of extra safety ratings that you have to do. So no, I don't think we're around the corner from space tourism. I also don't think we're around the corner from mining the moon. There is a significant amount of money and capital that needs to go into these things that we're just not seeing. States right now are their budgets are tight and they're not spending the way that they used to. And companies, while they're doing really interesting things, are having a hard time finding a market. And so while it's not necessarily a place where we can't get this technology, it's more about investment and how much money it takes to actually do these things. And so I mean, I'll openly admit it, I'm kind of a space pessimist. But there are plenty of people out there that are space optimists if you want a different picture on all of this.
There's so many different facets, and I want to ask, this might be a ridiculous question, but you never know. So let's just say a hypothetical. So we make contact, there's aliens, there's whatever it is. Is there going to be a whole, like, would the civil rights kind of situation fall under you because it's from space, or would that be something completely different?
So actually, early on in space law, there was a scholar named Andrew G. Haley, and he was an American lawyer, and he developed this field of law that was called meta law. And meta law was the notion of what legal sort of obligations and duties and rights exist between humans and potential extraterrestrials. And he kind of boiled meta law down into the golden rule of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And this actually kind of went along for a while, and another guy came along, and I can't remember his name. It may have been Coca, came along and said, maybe that's not right. Maybe we should do unto others as they would have us do unto them, because if an alien breathes methane, you shouldn't give it oxygen, which is what you would want. And so there are sort of these deep philosophical debates about what do we do if we make contact with intelligent life. There are also ethical debates on what do we do if we make contact with non-intelligent life. And so there is an international organization called the Committee on COSPAR, the Committee on Space Research, and they have a set of protocols that go into how we need to clean our spacecraft before we send them to places in order to that we can look around and see if we can find life there. Because if we send bacteria to Mars and then we discover our own bacteria, well, now we've messed up that ability to make a determination as to whether there was life on Mars at some point. So there's actually a lot of rich discussion around this. A lot of it is less legal and much more philosophical, but it's really fascinating stuff.
It is fascinating. I can't imagine that we have like restaurants with signs like humans only or something. You know what I mean? Like, what just happened? But It's funny that because I got a question from somebody when it was talking about satellite debris, space debris, and as a fellow American, we can own a lot of it. I'm sure a lot of it is from America. How do they
Yes,
deal with that? Because they're like private companies are just shooting that stuff into space. It might or might not be cleaned properly, and you have bacteria from Earth going out to space, which is probably not the best thing, I'm guessing. I'm not a biologist, but is there anything with space law that kind of deals with, orbital crowding or anything like that? Because I hear it's pretty prevalent. Like there's a lot of garbage floating around Earth. So
So I mean the basic physics of it are this, right? If a plane is flying overhead and it blows up, it just falls to the ground. We send a truck over there, it cleans it up. It's tragic, but we can clean up that mess. If something breaks up in orbit, it's still moving at orbital velocity. So it's moving in an orbit around the Earth very, very fast. So a paint chip can actually cause significant damage. There's a great picture you can find online of what a paint chip did to the windshield of the space shuttle. Took a huge divot out of it. So this is a big problem that we have, is that this debris is up there and it's going around. The unfortunate thing is we haven't really come up with a system to deal with this problem yet. The big thing in space right now is sort of to talk about this notion of sustainability, which is something that we get out of sort of international environmental law. But we haven't seen much movement towards actually finding a way to clean this up. There are several private companies that want to go up there and do it. But the way that things work in space is, if your satellite breaks up, you still own all of those pieces. And so for somebody to go clean that up, they need to get your permission. There is a lot of talk right now about how do we manage this? How do we first mitigate the creation of debris, but also clean up the debris that's out there? Most of this isn't happening at the legal level. It's happening sort of at a standards level or a guidelines level, something that's not binding, but that helps influence states and what they do. And so it is something that's really important. At the same time, we are now currently sending up these very large constellations like Starlink, which is only creating more orbital congestion. And just to give you a clear picture of this, 5 years ago, if you said, "Hey, how many things are in orbit?" I would have told you that there are, lots of debris, but 450 or so active satellites. As of today, I think there are more than 5,000 active satellites, and that is primarily attributable to one single constellation, which is Starlink. And so this is a critical problem that we have to begin to think about. And unfortunately, we're not moving very far forward on thinking about it.
that is scary. That almost like traps us on Earth, because how are you going to get through all that? And it's traveling fast, and like it's that is yeah, man, I'm not a fan of that. That's terrible.
This is something launch companies have already begun to complain because they have to try to find a hole to go through to get through these constellations. And Starlink is the biggest right now, but there's OneWeb, there's Kuiper. There are plans out there for more than 100,000 satellites to be in orbit. And I don't know what that looks like when we get to that. I don't know if we had a carrying capacity. I don't know what that means for deep space exploration, but it's certainly problematic.
Do you think there's eventually going to be companies coming up that take care of space debris to kind of get that out? I mean, theoretically, they couldn't bring it back to Earth. They just have to like push it out into space and change its trajectory, right?
Well, it depends where it is, right? And so in low Earth orbit, the usual notion is that we just deorbit it and it burns up in the atmosphere. That has its own potential pollution problem, which we're just now beginning to talk about, this notion that when you burn things up, they don't go away. They still stay up there, right? And these are heavy metals and whatnot. But there are companies that are certainly trying to do this. And probably the leader right now is a company called Astroscale, which is a Japanese company, but they have offices in the UK and the US as well. And they are actually trying to develop the technology to go up there and capture debris and either reorbit it or move it to what we might call a graveyard orbit. So that is probably the place where this begins, is at the commercial level. But it's again a problem of they're still trying to find a market for it because it's still economically better to not deal with your debris than to pay somebody else to deal with it.
I mean, the stuff that must be up there, especially like from the Cold War, where people are like shooting monkeys and dogs out in space, and like that stuff just floating around. Like, I can only imagine if extraterrestrials, intelligent life come and they're like, wait, you shot dogs into space? Like, you know, how crazy is that? We look like a really crazy species from the
I
outside.
mean, somebody had to go up there first.
Yeah, let's set a chimpanzee out there. That's horrible. Okay, so it's kind of late for our kids in Eastern Europe. We'll let them go, but I always ask this of all of our guests, Dr. Blount, Dr. PJ Blount, what kind of advice would you have for these kids as they go off into the world and figure out what kind of trails they want to blaze, what kind of lives they want to lead as somebody who's as accomplished in your field, whether they want to go into space law or something completely different? What advice do you have for them?
So as I said earlier, like I found my way into space law through a back door. I wasn't intending to be a space lawyer. I just kind of slipped into it. And so, there's a quote from Louis Pasteur that is, chance favors the prepared mind. And so I think that it's about having a prepared mind and looking for the doors that open and looking for the opportunities that are there. And so sometimes, you set out this goal and you're going to go for it, and that might not work. But be flexible and you'll find something that does work. And so I think that that's really the thing is recognizing that goals are great, but also you have to pay attention to what's around you and be flexible and adapt to what's going on. And that's how I've kind of gone about my career, and it's worked really well, I gotta say. So yeah, that's my advice.
That's great advice. So before I end the meeting for all, and guys, you can check this out on YouTube by the end of the week and Spotify and iTunes. Can we all unmute and collectively, can we say thank you to Dr. PJ Blount for taking time out of his day to talk to us? Thank you so much, doctor. We appreciate you greatly. Thank you, guys. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.